Nuclear hubris. The International Atomic Energy Agency has given Japan the green light to dump 1.3 million tons of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. The consequences will be dire, though we won't start seeing the physical impact of this short-sighted crime against humanity for years, if not decades. The truth is that tritium is dangerous when it gets into your body, and it takes a marine biologist with an international reputation to explain.
Why has nobody looked at the sea-to-land transfer of tritium? Now, this doesn't just apply to tritiated water as a kind of a sea-to-land transferred water vapor from breaking waves or from the vast expanses of wet sediments which are exposed at low tide. On a hot day, they're evaporating the water out of them. That water contains tritiated water. And if there's an onshore breeze, you'll be inhaling that. And it will also be dropping tritiated material out onto agricultural produce.
And that's just the start. Well, when Tim Deere Jones explains the impact of tritium on the body and how the marine environment will transfer it to your food, water, and the very air you breathe, you begin to understand the forever consequences of Japan's about-to-happen-unless-they-can-be-stopped radioactive water release, which will send all of us further into that awful seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been
drinking?
Welcome
to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Levy Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, since the International Atomic Energy Agency's approval of Japan's release of 1.3 million tons of tritium-contaminated radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean, it's time to look again at the dangers posed by this forever contamination of the world's waters. We hear from marine biologist Tim Deere Jones. He explains what tritium is, how it behaves, then reveals the many ways this intended, pending, imminent release by Japan of tritiated water into the Pacific Ocean puts people, marine life, the fishing industry, tourism, agriculture, and more at risk, including you and me, and why the nuclear industry and governments refuse to study the impact of such exposure. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, and more honest nuclear information than we will ever get out of the International Atomic Energy Agency. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 4, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting off today in Japan, where, to absolutely nobody's surprise, the International Atomic Energy Agency today, July 4th, released a report on its investigation, you might put that in quotes, into the planned discharge of treated water from Tokyo Electric Power Company's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. IAEA stated that the plan, quote, meets international safety standards, end quote, and has negligible impact on people and the environment. There was no acknowledgement of a document leaked from inside the International Atomic Energy by a whistleblower, reported on Nuclear Hot Seat number 627, dated June 27, that pointed to apparent and ongoing collusion between the Japanese government and the IAEA regarding how approval of this process would be released. That document was dated June 1, 2023, well before the final assessment was going to be announced, And while both Japan and the IAEA have denounced the document as false, all of its guidelines were reflected in the way that the announcement was made and the content of materials given to the press and announced to the public. Over the past 2 years, the IAEA formed a survey team of experts from Europe, the United States, South Korea, China, and other countries that interviewed TEPCO, the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, and the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, and conducted on-site inspections at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The report stressed that, quote, "The discharge of treated water is a decision made by the Japanese government, and this report neither recommends nor endorses that policy." There has been strong opposition to the ocean discharge of 1.3 million tons of tritium-contaminated radioactive water that has come from the governments of China, South Korea, Hong Kong, and the Pacific Island nations, as well as domestic fishermen in Japan. A statement by the Pacific Islands Forum Secretary General Henry Puna asserted that the Pacific Islands Forum remains fully committed to addressing strong concerns for the significance of the potential threat of nuclear contamination to the health and security of the Blue Pacific, its people, and prospects. Japan is now focused on making a final decision on the specific timing of the start of the discharge, which has been set for this summer, while they are seeking understanding of the plan both in Japan and abroad. "We understand the plan. We just don't approve. And there doesn't seem to be any way yet to make you hear and respond to our concerns." The other nuclear hotspot in the world and one of great concern is in Ukraine, where that country is reportedly preparing for a nuclear explosion at the Zaporizhzhia 6-reactor nuclear power plant. The facility has been under Russian control since March of 2022. But Russian troops have now been ordered to leave the power plant by July 5th, this according to Defense Intelligence of Ukraine. They went on to state, "The latest data indicates that the occupying forces are gradually leaving the territory of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Three employees of Rosatom, who led the Russians' actions, were among the first to leave the facility, aka rats leaving a sinking ship." Rosatom is a Russian state corporation specializing in nuclear energy. Ukrainian employees who have signed a contract with Rosatom have also been advised to evacuate. Now, the Ukrainian armed forces are reporting that foreign objects similar to explosive devices were placed on the outer roof of Zaporizhzhia's Units 3 and 4, with the intention making it appear that Ukrainian forces are shelling their own plant. According to Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, if the outer roof means the roof of the auxiliary and control buildings, then such explosives would not likely penetrate the roof, but could cause concrete spalling, resulting in fractured, compromised concrete. This would not result in a nuclear explosion that we associate with the atomic bomb and the mushroom cloud, but it could release more radiation than was released at Chernobyl. Ukraine's chief of military intelligence, Kirill Budanov, told the New Statesman magazine that Russian troops had rigged the station's cooling ponds with explosives, and if destroyed, that could lead to the reactors melting down. Ukraine has been holding drills to prepare emergency services with how to deal with a potential radioactive disaster. Firefighters in hazmat gear simulated decontaminating people from radiation during an evacuation. And as if Ukraine is not poised on the brink of enough nuclear disaster, the Biden administration is expected to supply that country with highly controversial depleted uranium munitions, which would be in addition to the State Department's December 22nd of 2022 approval of the sale to Poland of as many as 112,000 depleted uranium shells. DU, as it is referred to, has been likened to committing nuclear war without the explosion, as studies have shown that a significantly increased rate of birth abnormalities has occurred among children of U.S. Gulf War veterans and among Iraqi children born after 1991. Here in the U.S., at least a little bit of good news, former Ohio Speaker Larry Householder was sentenced on Thursday, June 29, to 20 years in prison for orchestrating a nearly $60 million illegal bribery scheme that fueled his return to political power. Of course, it's all about nuclear. Here with the details is Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
It was hard not to gloat last week when the ringleader of the Ohio nuclear bribery and corruption scandal, Larry Householder, received 20 years, the maximum prison sentence, for his role in orchestrating a bribe-ridden bailout for FirstEnergy's failing nuclear plants. The former Republican Speaker of the House, along with four associates, had been found guilty in March of what was described as the biggest criminal racketeering conspiracy in Ohio history. Householder had concocted a nefarious scheme to extract $61 million from FirstEnergy, first to ensure his re-election and that of enough political allies to guarantee his return to the House speakership, and then to pass a $1.3 billion bailout bill that would help rescue FirstEnergy's two failing nuclear plants. But it all unraveled, and on June 29th, Householder received that 20-year sentence, which he, of course, vows to appeal, not because he is sorry, other than for himself, something the judge dryly noted when he told Householder, "Beyond financial greed, I think you just like power. You weren't serving the people, you were serving yourself." What Householder served to himself was a share of that $61 million used to buy votes, pay for ads, and eventually interfere with petitioners trying to repeal the bailout bill. But it also paid for Householder's credit card debt and repairs to his Florida home. Ohio GOP Chairman Matt Borges was sentenced a day after Householder to 5 years in federal prison. Two others had earlier pled guilty and testified against Householder and Borges, while a fifth took his own life. But theirs is not an isolated case. Meanwhile, in Illinois, the former House Speaker, Democrat Mike Madigan, was indicted in March 2022 on 22 counts in an alleged $3 million criminal enterprise that included racketeering conspiracy, attempted extortion, and bribery. Madigan is accused of leading efforts to persuade utility, Commonwealth Edison, a subsidiary of the country's biggest nuclear plant owner, Exelon, to provide hundreds of thousands of dollars to himself and associates, as well as jobs to Madigan allies for work that was often never performed. In return, ComEd was assured of favorable legislation. Madigan faces trial on April 1, 2024. His three co-defendants have already been found guilty on 9 different counts of conspiracy, bribery, and falsification of records. And then there's South Carolina and the V.C. Summer new nuclear power plant debacle. That project, 2 Westinghouse AP1000 reactors, was cancelled mid-construction after draining billions of dollars from customers and the Public Service Commission. Executives of the plant owner, Skarner, had lied about the lack of progress in order to secure further funding. Westinghouse executives were charged with conspiracy, wire fraud, securities fraud, and causing a publicly traded company to keep a false record. Almost none of this made any press outside of the states in which it happened. But the pattern here ought to be getting the attention of our nuclear-mad Congress. This series of high crimes and corruption, no mere misdemeanors here, should be warning enough, along with the extreme costs and delays, and even failure of completion, to end their obsession with promoting new nuclear and using our money to fund it. I'm Linda Pence Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Thanks, Linda. At least we got one win in last week. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, it would be nice if wishing for a nuke-free world would make it happen, but it won't. The entire fuel chain, from uranium mining on mostly indigenous lands that leaves a legacy of radioactive waste, to the manufacture of nuclear weapons and reactor fuel, to the known health dangers of living near a nuclear reactor, to the forever dangerous legacy of so-called spent fuel rods, as well as nuclear weapons, it's all out there, poisoning the land, the air, the water, and, unfortunately, us. And all of it is supported by a financially well-funded nuclear industry PR propaganda machine that spends millions every month to get their message embedded into the news cycle and the public's brains. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We're now in our 13th year, and we're the only podcast where you can reliably get a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information, and that's every week. We bring you stories and insights that the nukesters and their political minions would rather you not know. To celebrate the start of our 13th year, I invite you to support the show by donating to help cover our monthly running costs. How about $13 in honor of each of the 12 years and one to grow on? You could also make it a monthly recurring donation of any amount, as little as $5, the same as you would spend for a cup of coffee and a tip. So come on, buy Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee, which we won't drink, but we will apply to our expenses. Help us continue to be a platform, a voice that helps amplify the voices of others who have important things to say, to you and to power. So right now, go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a red button. Click on it. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to us through our email, info@nuclearhotseat.com. Either way, it's tax deductible, so donate now. And know that whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Tim Deere Jones is an internationally recognized marine biologist, a researcher and consultant who specializes in analysis of the radiation threats to our planet's waters from a wide range of nuclear sources. With the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, having now given its approval to Japan to dump more than 1.3 million tons of tritium-contaminated radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, an action plan to start as soon as later this month, it's a good time to remind people what we know about what tritium is, how it behaves in water, and the true nature of what we will face from this passive nuclear war being conducted on the world's largest body of water. For that, I know of no one better to ask than Tim Deere Jones. We spoke originally on Saturday, March 18, 2023. Tim Deere Jones, I am excited to have you this morning as my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby. I'm pleased to be with you, and it's going to be an interesting conversation about an important subject.
Tritium. That's what we're talking about, which is on everybody's mind because of Japan's insistence that they will be releasing tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. So it's important for us to understand, what are we facing here? Let's start with the basics. What is tritium?
Tritium is a radioactive isotope of hydrogen, and because we're talking about tritium in the sea, it's important to remember that hydrogen is an important component of water, H2O, and there are natural forms of tritium, and there's an awful lot of man-made tritium now on the planet since the 1940s.
How long does tritium remain radioactive?
Okay, well, tritium has a half-life of 12.3 years, or thereabouts. In its normal form in tritiated water or tritium-contaminated water. Most people agree, I think, that you need to go through 10 half-lives before any of your radioactive constituents, whatever they may be, are rendered sort of pretty harmless. So in the case of tritium, we're talking about 123 years.
You mentioned natural and, I would assume, unnatural, meaning man-made tritium. Explain the difference between the two and where they come from.
It is perfectly correct to say that we do have natural tritium. The enormous bulk of it is produced in the upper atmosphere as a result of solar radioactivity interactions between atmospheric hydrogen and the solar radioactivity. That produces, and I will give you one number here, that produces 10 to the 16. So that's 10 with 16 noughts after it, becquerels of tritium a year, most of which falls down to the planetary surface, falls into the water. If it falls onto the land, it ends up being washed into the water or incorporated into plant life. On the other hand, if you look at the human production of tritium, it's very rapidly proves itself to be much, much, much more significant than the amount of tritium which is produced by natural sources. for instance, atmospheric weapons testing produced about 10,000 times the amount of tritium that is produced naturally a year.
Meaning still the leftover materials from weapons testing is still producing.
Yeah, because we haven't lost the half-lives yet. You know, you think you've got to go through your 123 years before the material you've produced has sort of worked itself down to a state where it does nothing and causes no damage and its radioactivity content is very low. So we haven't got to that stage. And meanwhile, we have been generating more and more as a result of sea dumping, which was stopped in the 1980s, but an awful lot of radioactive tritium was thrown overboard, shipped into the sea. And meanwhile, again, ever since then, we've had a lot of nuclear activity, nuclear power stations, nuclear generators, fuel processing, nuclear fuel production, experiments with fission, as well as fusion. And all of these produce large amounts of tritium, most of which now ends up into the aquatic systems because it was understood quite early on that discharges of tritiated water as tritium in steam to the atmosphere was causing health problems to populations. This was way back in Kennedy's era when the first weapons test ban treaties were worked on. That was one of the problems that they were worried about then. But since then, the atmospheric testing has stopped. But the civil nuclear process is going on, and pretty much everything that we do in the nuclear industry produces tritium, which is either discharged to atmosphere or discharged to water.
This is, of course, a major issue right now in Japan because of the tritiated water from Fukushima. It's also an issue about tritiated water being released from Indian Point in New York, and also into Massachusetts Bay from the Pilgrim Station. So this is an international issue that we are dealing with. Explain how humans become exposed to tritium. Where do they get it from, and what does it do to them?
What you're talking about is kind of the end point of a lot of these sites. So the end point of the Fukushima disaster, the end point of the Pilgrim unit, because that's been closed down and they're now looking to get rid of their final waste out of that site. But don't forget that all your other boiling water reactors, pressurized water reactors, are continually discharging large amounts of tritium into the atmospheric and the marine environment with a bias towards the marine environment. So my area of interest has been the impact of marine discharges of tritium. And what we see is that tritium has been considered in the past, because it's what they define, the nuclear industry define, as a weak beta emitter. Now, beta emissions are shortwave and not very strong. So, for instance, they don't necessarily penetrate the skin like a gamma or an X-ray would. And so for that reason, they're considered to be relatively harmless. But one of the big problems that has surfaced sort of in the late 1990s, and the work on it has grown subsequently, is the understanding that actually tritium in watercourses quickly becomes absorbed into protein materials and organic materials. So it'll absorb onto proteins, it'll absorb onto organic materials, it'll absorb onto carbon materials, and it'll absorb onto things called lipids, which are kind of natural fats. And when that happens, we call it organically bound tritium. And that puts us into a completely different setup in regards of dosimetry.
When you talk about proteins and organic material that the tritium gets bound to, are you talking about fish and aquatic life and seaweed and minute organisms that then feed the rest of the ocean?
You got it, Libby, you got it. It's the microorganisms are the first port of call for your water-based tritium, because they are organic, because they have proteins, because they have lipids, and because a lot of them have carbon bases to them as well. So these little tiny things absorb all this stuff. And then, as you pointed out, everybody above them in the food chain starts to bioaccumulate and biomagnify as the little ones eat the smaller ones, and then the medium-sized ones eat the little ones, and then the big ones eat the medium-sized ones. And as you go up the food chain, you get enormous magnitude, so that in the Bristol Channel, which is an area that I've been doing desk and field research on for some decades now, this is UK waters, we find that while you may have a level of 10 becquerels to the litre in the seawater in the Bristol Channel, by the time you get to the top predators, or as far as you can go, or as far as the nuclear industry and the regulators have measured, you find you've got 36,000 becquerels. So you've got a huge biomagnification occurring up the food chain. Now, there has been no study on human beings in that kind of situation. The investigations of tritium impacts on humans have been for nuclear workers receiving massive doses either on the skin as a result of a nuclear accident on site. So we don't have these dietary studies, and we don't have them relating to human beings in the context of organically bound tritium. So there's a huge area of ignorance here about the health effects to human populations of organically bound tritium. But what you can see from looking at the wildlife is that biomagnification occurs. And there are studies which have been done on mammals, such as mice and rats and monkeys. And that finds that one of the things that tritium quite likes to involve itself with is RNA and DNA. Therefore, now you know that those two, RNA and DNA, help to code and produce and manage genetic sequences. So this is a very significant potential, which, as far as I can see, has not been thoroughly examined to date.
So it sounds like, certainly Japan being the prime example right now, but in other instances where tritiated water releases are being discussed, it's misdirection for them to say, okay, this is what it does in the water, because the bigger problem is how what's in the water gets absorbed into the life stream of plants and animals, and then gets bioaccumulated up. So when Japan says, we're just releasing X amount of tritium and it's not really a problem, they're not looking at the full problem. And I think there are some obvious political reasons for that. How does the nuclear industry, and I'm thinking specifically here of the International Atomic Energy Agency and also the International Commission on Radiological Protection, or ICRP, how do those major nuclear industry organizations deal with this information about tritium, or do they deal with it at all?
I think they skip over it. It's my interpretation of what I read. And of course, I'm an unorthodox as far as they're concerned. They have their orthodoxy, and their orthodoxy says that, as I've said earlier, you know, the tritium is a weak beta emitter, and they don't seem to be particularly interested in addressing this issue of organically bound tritium, which completely changes the whole, you know, it's a smoking gun, which is hidden behind the idea that tritium, it's natural. And it's a weak beta emitter, and we put it in the water and it dissolves, and it'll keep dissolving. I've read statements saying that it dissolves into infinity. So, you know, the proposal is that essentially it disappears once it's got the chance to mix in properly, say with an ocean's worth of seawater. They ignore the issue of the organically bound tritium, whereby it may have dissolved so that in the Bristol Channel, as I said earlier, it's reduced from the content of the radioactive discharge from the nuclear power station. When it's discharged, you can measure it, and it's at 10 becquerels to the litre off the end of the pipeline. And the further away you get in the seawater, it's lower and lower. But if you start to look at tritium in the shellfish and the seabirds that are eating the shellfish, then you realise that no, it's not dissolving and disappearing. There are methods by which it can reconcentrate, get into the food chain. For a country like Japan, which eats a lot of fish, it eats a lot of shellfish, and not only that, but they're doing aquaculture and eating seaweed as well. this is all a big deal. So, I mean, in the UK, per head of population, we eat relatively little fish, whereas the Japanese are eating 15, 20 times more fish as individuals than the British population is, because that's the way they go. And a lot of Pacific nations, I mean, we could get into the economic side of it here, if this is appropriate, but a lot of Pacific nations are fishing tuna, for instance. Now, there's plenty of evidence out there to show that previous discharges from Fukushima have had an impact, a radiological impact on all sorts of Pacific tuna, because it's only recently been pointed out that there is evidence that a number of yellowfin tuna, skipjacks, the big blues, and so on, several species of tuna are breeding and rearing, and their juveniles are being reared off the Japanese coast, off that coast, that eastern facing coast of Honshu. So you've got your tuna there, and then, okay, the tuna migrate and they go round and round the Pacific, more or less in a manner, if you like, following the clockwise currents which broadly move around the Pacific. So they're going to come back to the Fukushima area and they're going to be going through that circular current, which is carrying the tritium, which is going to be released from Fukushima, and they're going to be building it up. Now, female tuna, female fish can pass some of their tritium burden onto their eggs. Laboratory studies have shown that fish eggs produced by female fish have been fed tritiated water. Those fish eggs contain tritium, which is bound to the DNA and the RNA. So we're back to the genetic sequencing again of the fish. So they, but the females lose some of their body burden, whereas the males have no way of expressing. So they will continue to build up a body burden of tritium. Big tuna, some of the big blue tuna, can live for 15, 20 years. Now, it's my argument that probably in 15 or 20 years, let's say TEPCO do release their water this year, in 15 or 20 years' time, there'll be some damn big blue tuna going round and round in the Pacific with very high body burdens of tritium, and somebody's going to catch one of these big tuna and say, hey, look, it's worth so many hundreds or thousands of dollars, and people are going to buy chunks of it and happily devour it, but they're going to be giving themselves a big dose of tritium, of organically bound tritium, in that process.
Do you eat sushi?
No, I don't eat sushi.
I haven't since Fukushima.
Yeah, good for you.
What are the other delivery methods by which human beings can be contaminated by this tritium water? It's not just the fish in the water.
There's the digestion, the dietary route. But for me, equally significant is the inhalation route. Tritiated water, one of the things that struck me when I first started reading about tritium in water was that it was explained to me that tritiated water behaves just like any other water. For instance, when atmospheric discharges of tritium from nuclear power stations are made, they are in the form of tritiated steam. So it's steam, condensed water, loaded with the tritium. So once the tritium is in the water, you can't remove it. Doesn't matter if it turns into steam or water vapor, it won't be removed. Now, we know from studies that have been conducted in the UK that the radionuclide cesium-137 dissolves in water. And there are studies from the UK and from numerous academics, but also early studies from the nuclear industry, who stopped those studies pretty quickly because they began to show unfortunate results as far as they were concerned. But those studies showed that cesium-137 dissolved in water would blow ashore across the shoreline in sea spray and micro droplets from marine aerosols. So this is like kind of fog kind of droplets, you know. And we know, I mean, I'm talking to you from Wales, and there are areas of the Welsh coast where studies have shown that sea to land transferred cesium has been found 10 miles inland on agricultural produce. So first of all, your dietary isn't just seafood. You can also get a dietary dose of sea to land transferring water dissolved materials. So that would include tritium, but tritium hasn't been studied. So I shall refer again to cesium. We know that you can get a dietary dose of cesium on terrestrial produce, but it's marine cesium. but you can find it on agricultural produce up to 10 miles inland. So that gives you a much broader critical contact group, or coastal critical group, as we call them in the UK, people who are most exposed by reason of their habitats and their diets and their lifestyles, a much bigger critical group of people who are in receipt of sea to land transfer doses. Now, if tritiated water behaves like any other water, then it follows logically and scientifically that it will behave in the same way as the cesium does. So my argument is, why has nobody looked at the sea to land transfer of tritium? Now, this doesn't just apply to tritiated water as a kind of a sea to land transferred water vapor from breaking waves, or from the vast expanses of wet sediments which are exposed at low tide. Think of a beach. Think of some beaches which are very shallow can be. We've got beaches in the UK which are a mile wide at the low tide because they're very shallow, but they're wet. On a hot day, they're evaporating the water out of them. That water contains cesium and tritiated water. And if there's an onshore breeze, you'll be inhaling that, and it will also be dropping tritiated material out onto agricultural produce. But then it's not just that, because we know that this effect is actually larger and greater if organic material is blown ashore. And we know that there are microbes and microbiology in the marine environment, and little tiny particles of dead seaweed and other organic material. And we know, because that stuff has been captured, blowing across the shoreline, it's been captured in muslin nets. And we know that that stuff is also blowing ashore as part of the sea to land transfer. So there's another dose pathway here, and that is the sea to land transfer. So if it's blowing ashore, you will be breathing it. And if it can reach 10 miles inland, as has been shown in the UK, then you will be 10 miles worth of people, if you like to think of it that way, maybe inhaling that stuff and getting it into their lungs, from which it passes into the bloodstream, from where it passes into the various body organs, brain, heart, you name it. At the same time, I don't know how things are in Japan, but I guess probably in the UK you have what are called salt marsh fed animal products. So it's a big deal in the UK is selling salt marsh sheep. So sheep feeding on salt marsh pastures, intertidal, you know, stuff which gets flooded in the winter and during periods of extra high tide. Then when that happens, organic material at OBT, organically bound tritium, and tritiated water will be coming ashore onto those salt marshes, contaminating the organic material that's there, the grasses and the herbs, which makes the sheep taste so nice. But at the same time, people will be getting a dose of tritiated material from that. I mean, again, in the UK, we've had numerous towns recently, and it's becoming more frequent as sea level rise occurs and storms increase in velocity. We're getting towns, seaside towns, which are being flooded from the sea. So that's bringing tritiated water. And almost invariably, when that happens, those seaside towns have to do a lot of cleanup afterwards, because a lot of mud and organic waste and sand is also brought ashore. And all that stuff will be contaminated with tritium from the tritium contaminated sea. So if you start to put massive pulses in, as is proposed at Pilgrim or at Fukushima, or, you know, if you have an accident with a water-cooled power station or cooling ponds, etc., where tritium is lying, then all those pathways are potential pathways of deliverance. But the IAEA and the ICRP do not list those pathways as pathways of relevance. So they haven't changed their pathways of deliveries since the 1970s. Despite all this new evidence which has occurred, I've been writing about this stuff for a decade now and sending it off in consultation submissions and requests for comment from the nuclear industry. And honestly, Libby, it's astonishing. They just ignore it. They don't bother to argue with me about it. They just blank it and ignore it. The longer this goes on, the more convinced I am that it's so tricky, they don't want to talk about it at all.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
That's right.
Has there ever been within the industry, a significant challenge to their ignorance, their blind spot, their not paying attention to this new information?
No, not within the industry. There hasn't. There have been one or two people who have worked from the industry and resigned from it, who have raised issues about tritium. I think they have the same response that I have, because people like Pilgrim have probably run into Dr. Ian Fairley, who is a considerable expert on the issue, although I don't think his speciality is marine tritium, but he's certainly written extensively about tritium in its other forms and its other forms of discharge and its uses. But I don't think he gets any more traction than I can with the nuclear industry, despite the fact that he has a long association with various nuclear bodies.
So there's no monitoring. There have been no studies. The nuclear industry turns a blind eye and a deaf ear to any information that might contradict their promotion of nuclear as quote unquote clean and green, which is just none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a look specifically at Japan and what they are planning to do. They have not only said that they want to, but they plan to, and they've put the mechanism in place to release more than 1.3 million tons of tritiated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, starting possibly as soon as this summer. There's been international pushback against it, but they are moving forward. What do you consider will be the impact of this release?
Yeah, it's a desperate situation, isn't it? Because they are pushing forwards not only the industrial body in question, TEPCO, but they seem to have the support of everybody they need to have the support of. Don't worry about the public, but provided you've got your Japanese Nuclear Regulation Committee and the IAEA and people like that backing you, you're all right. But somebody is going to have to pick up the pieces. And I suppose the answer to that from the industry point of view is if they can PR it well enough, they can cover it up, push it through, and then hush-hush any impacts that might occur. Now, I have seen these sort of situations occur in other scenarios. I've worked extensively on some major oil spills, and I've seen the oil companies come into a town where an oil spill has occurred, take it over and work a very good PR job and divide the community by turning some against the others and causing confusion. And I guess that's what the nuclear industry is going to do as this unfolds. But as far as the communities, let us say, in the Pacific or in Cape Cod are concerned, I think the potential is there for there to be a very significant economic impact. First of all, areas where nuclear industry is, I mean, in the UK, for instance, the Sellafield site. Sellafield used to be a tourist area. It's no longer a tourist area. So that's a relatively small site compared to the Pacific Ocean. But there's an example of what can happen. There was a local fishing industry at Sellafield. There isn't a local fishing industry there any longer. So there is a fishing industry slightly further afield, using bigger boats that are fishing further away from the Sellafield sea area anyway. So if you've got prize agricultural products or prize marine food products, and then there is a threat of a radioactive pollution labelling of those products, then the market's going to fall off. So whether the nuclear industry can find allies enough and a persuasive advertising campaign to offset these things, I don't know. But I mean, we have seen in the UK islands where there was a very high death rate, a very high cancer incidences, and that I can link to very high presence of sea to land transferring radioactivity. But those have been, from a campaigning point of view, those have been squashed and overwhelmed by nuclear industry PR. And I mean, you know, here in the UK now, as a campaigner, there are lots and lots of citizens groups who are very anxious about their local nuclear power stations and the more generalized impact of nuclear discharges to air and water. But they get no traction with government. They get no traction with the media, because it seems that government and media are very susceptible to powerful lobbying and what we might call goodie giving, if you can see what I mean, for journalists and government ministers and MPs to go and visit nuclear sites, be given a good dinner, perhaps be sent abroad to a conference that they don't have to attend, but they get to go abroad and say they were at the conference. These sort of things make it a lot easier for the nuclear industry to win the publicity battle. Now, there are hardly, I mean, what have we got? We've probably got 15 or 20 fairly large newspapers in the UK. And I would say that none of the big ones are really anti-nuclear. And all of them, even those which occasionally publish an article which is critical of the nuclear industry, when you sit down and count up the pro-nuclear and the anti-nuclear, you find that the anti-nuclear is very much in the minority. And this is something we can't quite understand, because we keep producing these documents and asking these questions of the nuclear industry, and then saying to government and MPs, hey, we're asking these questions. Here's academics who have produced this academic evidence, and we're putting it to the nuclear industry and nuclear regulators and saying, but what about this? And we're not getting any answers. So I think that probably there will be an impact. I've talked about Tudor, for instance. I think those Pacific islands, and particularly as you get closer, think of Hawaii, think of your West Coast in the US.
It seems that if there's going to be meaningful pushback against Japan, it's going to have to come from the international community. And certainly there has been outreach, there has been complaint, there has been noise coming from the Pacific Island nations, which you have mentioned, especially the Marshall Islands and that part of the Pacific. There has been pushback from Korea. Taiwan did a study that showed that Japan's Fukushima radioactive water would reach that country's waters in 1.5 years. And now the big kahuna, the 800-pound gorilla, China, has been objecting for a while, but they have just recently, in the last week, raised the pitch of their rhetoric to where it's becoming much more threatening. It's really heating up. And we have to face the fact that this water will be reaching the west coast of North America, specifically the United States, within 5 years. So we are as much at risk as any place else. Do you think that it's possible for the international pushback to have any impact on Japan's decision? And if so, what form would that have to take for Japan to sit up and go, oh, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
That's a very, very interesting and almost unanswerable question. I think one of the problems for me when I look at this, I'm aware of the fact that all over Japan, the public are opposed to this move. I've spoken to trade unions and fishermen's groups and civil groups in Japan, both by writing and also by podcast, on these issues. And I know there are a lot of people not happy with the proposals. Now, those proposals are not going to be in one big lump. That discharge, I see various figures quoted, but that discharge from Fukushima is going to be taking place for some years on a round-the-year basis, isn't it? So that makes the issue even worse. And I mean, I think one of the big problems is that a lot of the nations and politicians who could lean on the Japanese actually represent nuclear states. And given that the nuclear industry has very cleverly and inexplicably managed to win the high ground on the nuclear is green and doesn't produce significant carbon, and so it's going to save us from climate change and global warming, that's played very happily into the hands of pro-nuclear protagonists and those nuclear states that I referenced. And you look at the number of nuclear states and they are growing every year, you know, the Japanese and the Koreans and the French and the British and the Russians and the Chinese are all busy trying to sell reactors to states that don't have reactors at the moment. So that's going to grow. And I do think that the position taken by Korea and China is very bold, because they are a nuclear state. And this does put them in the position, their complaints about Fukushima puts them in the position that were they to have a similar accident, it would make it more difficult for them to follow the same course that the Japanese are going to follow. But the states that prefer to either not vote against the Japanese move, they are the states that also have heavily invested in nuclear, and they may well be thinking that if we had an accident like Fukushima, it would be really handy for us to be able to sling this kind of waste into the oceans and claim that it dissolves and it's not a problem. And so if they object to the Japanese proposal, then they put themselves in a sort of a dichotomous position, a bit of a hypocritical position. I don't know what it'll take, because it seems to me that the history of the nuclear industry indicates that the nuclear industry itself, in the end, believes itself to be above and beyond public opinion and to be above and beyond public concerns. And it seems to be able to capture governments and regulatory agencies and media in a way which is not unprecedented, because we've seen the tobacco industry and the agricultural chemical industry do the same thing in the past. And they're really just following that same pattern. They can conjure up their own biased research. They can lean on people in all sorts of ways. They can rubbish people like you and me and those of us who are anxious and concerned. And I'm not really very hopeful in the current situation that Japan can be stopped. And therefore, we're going to have to get on the top of that. If they do it, there needs to be a major effort, and I don't know where it's going to come from, except from citizens, to actually do something to try and observe and report the effects of what is happening at Fukushima, if that discharge does occur. Otherwise, what can you do? You could try the United Nations, but how many states which are signatories of the United Nations Charter are nuclear? A good few of them now. Who sits on the Security Council and can veto anything? They're all nuclear states, except for the observer states there. I find it very, very depressing that the nuclear industry has been able to launch this takeover of the drivers of international politics and international environmental concern. In the end, it's like a lot of things. It comes down to we the people and whether we can wake up enough of our respective national populations to what's happening so that we can swing it on a national basis. I don't know what the Japanese have to do. The Japanese have done demonstrations, there's shouts of public concern. They've had a Fukushima. They've had people being removed from their ancestral homes, leaving their animals behind, leaving their homes and their livelihoods behind. We've seen it at Chernobyl. And we've seen it at Chelyabinsk and Mayak in Russia. We've seen it at Sellafield in the UK, where there was a fire in 57. And they just basically skated all over it. And there were reports as far away as Ireland after that 57 fire that people were suffering health impacts. Seems pretty certain that empirical evidence is there, but it's been ignored by the regulators and the governments. So I think the only thing to do is what happened, say, at Greenham Common in the UK, when British women took it upon themselves to go and lay siege to a base where US nuclear weapons were being stored and readied for, you know, in the event of a nuclear exchange. And they actually, in the end, those ladies, having invested themselves in spending years and years camping out at that site and keeping the issue in the public eye, they won the case. And those nuclear weapons were removed from the UK. Didn't take all the nuclear weapons away, because we have our own nuclear deterrent, but at least we took a third-party nuclear deterrent away, and that was civilian action, and it was women, and the advantage there was that it was harder to beat women up, turn the police and the paramilitaries onto them, and they had staying power and enormous strength and courage, and it may well fall upon women and children to do the job this time, because the forces of law and order and security and civil nuclear police are pretty much all male, and it's hard for men to start beating up women and throwing women and babies and children about. So it may be necessary. It's not impossible, I add, but it's hard. And the PR is terrible in a civilized society and a culture. So it may be down to, you know, mass civilian action might be the only way to stop it. And we have contemplated, when I worked with Greenpeace International on the shipment of high-level waste through from the UK and France to Japan via Australian territorial seas, Greenpeace International did actually put a nuclear flotilla out there. So they had sailing boats sailing around in circles in the Tasman Sea in an attempt to block the passage of those nuclear ships. might need something like that. You know, mass demonstrations of fishermen sitting off the Fukushima discharge point, putting themselves in the water, perhaps. You know, I mean, it's difficult to know. I mean, desperate situations kind of demand desperate tactics. And I do think that it's some nuclear industry and governments will probably say I'm irresponsible to say this, but I think I don't mean investing and taking over and trying to dismantle a nuclear site, but I just mean making such a huge presence that it's impossible for the newspapers and the TV programmes and the radio programmes and the MPs and the governments and the regulators to ignore it. Because in the end, whether the science is right or wrong, if communities don't want something to happen, for God's sake, don't they have a right in their own community to say, we don't want this to happen here, and for those who propose that action to be thus stymied and they have to go away?
Tim Deere Jones, thank you for this. I now understand more about tritium than I ever imagined possible. I'm sure the same can be said for the listeners. It's a crucial issue for us to understand, and I think it's been the missing piece in the discussion of what these releases of tritiated water would actually do to the waterways and the life force and the DNA and all the rest. And for this intensive and extensive education into tritium, I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Levy. Thank you very much for the opportunity to share these thoughts and the results of my desk research on this subject. It's been a pleasure, as always, to exchange information and views with you. Bless you, and may your podcast live for a long time yet.
UK-based marine biologist, researcher, and consultant Tim Deere Jones. We will also be talking to Tim for next week's show that specifically will address the issues surrounding Japan's now approved, though not by you, me, or any of us, release of the radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 4th, 2023. If you want to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel, or just cut to the chase. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. Scroll down looking for the yellow box, and in that opt-in box, list your first name and an email address. With that, every week, as soon as the show posts, you will get one email with that link and a short description of the show's content. That way, you will never risk missing your weekly dose of nuclear news from a different perspective. You can help us learn about the stories we need to cover as well. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all, anything, and we will really appreciate and honor your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed. As long as you cite the program, the website, the names of any guests you quote, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, the Earth is a rock in the middle of a bubble in the middle of nowhere. What happens on Earth stays on Earth, and radioactivity released today will long outlive the human race. There you've got it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.